Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Indeed, good morning. What an exciting show we've got today, because today it is not only the Rugby World Cup. Oh yes, we're all ready for Australia, New Zealand. No, but it is also Halloween. So here on Science Mixtape, we have decided to combine the two, and we are going to be bringing you the horror of rugby. Here to help us do that this week is our special guest, Professor Alison Pollock, author of Tackling Rugby and Professor of Public Health Research and Policy at Queen Mary University of London. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us today. We're in a new studio at the moment with spooky lighting. It's very ambient. Alison will be sharing with us some horrifying statistics, horrific injuries in all of their gory detail, and how we can make rugby safer for children. But we also want to hear from you. So if you have any rugby horror stories, you can tweet us at Soho Radio and share them with us. Also coming up, we'll be making some ghostly M&Ms, finding out why some people like scary films, and deciding once and for all the ultimate question: what is the deadliest animal? Alison, do you have any ideas what the deadliest animal might be?
Oh no, black widow spider?
I mean, that is pretty poisonous. You definitely wouldn't want to be bitten
by
that.
A snake, some sort of snake.
We will be revealing all at the end of the show. So tweet us again if you think you know what the deadliest animal is. But now, it's a Halloween special, so Alison, you've chosen the songs, but we've also said they need to fit with our Halloween theme. And what have you gone for first?
Well, I had great fun doing this because I put a WhatsApp around my family and friends, and by common consensus, we've come up with a number of songs. But my first one is from the 1950s, I Put a Spell on You. And it's not the well-known Nina Simone version. I've chosen Screamin' Jay Hawkins. What's up?
On you, because you're mine.
News. What an excellent version of that song that was. Really, really loved it. But on to science news, and one of the most horrifying stories this week from the World Health Organization is that you, my listener, probably have herpes. 2/3 of the world's population under the age of 50, so that's 3.7 billion people we're talking about, are infected with the herpes type 1 virus. There are two types. So the type 1 is the strain that typically you would see as cold sores around the mouth, but most of the time you don't actually see any symptoms. Because most of the time what this virus does, when it gets into your body, it gets into your nerves, and then it just stays there. And tends not to do anything. We say it's dormant. It's just kind of like sleeping in your nerves. But things can bring it out. So if you're stressed, if you're ill, if you've got a fever, or for some people, sun exposure or even your periods can make these cold sores come to life. And this type one, you can get just from skin to skin contact. Someone doesn't even have to have cold sores. If they've got the virus in them and they touch your skin, you get that virus as well. So we often actually get herpes as babies, you know, from our parents holding us, because they probably have it as well. And then there is the type 2 herpes, which is the sexually transmitted one. And if you have either of the viruses, you have herpes. So there we go.
Well, it's a bit puzzling why the WHO has chosen to focus on herpes, isn't it? I mean, there are so many more really important conditions and diseases. I know it's a common disease, but you're sort of slightly anxious to what's going on behind it. Certainly, it can result in shingles in older age when the virus is lying dormant. And of course, there are new vaccines for shingles. So you're wondering whether we're being softened up for yet another very expensive vaccine.
Oh, I love it. The skeptic brain.
Well, so I think true. We have to question, why is this being put out there?
Yeah.
And what's the evidence that we can do anything about it in terms of treatment? Of course, prevention is really important, but when it's so commonplace, as you say.
Well, I have friends who are doctors, and they say, well, yeah, we don't really bother testing for it because it's not normally that harmful at all, and so many people have it.
Yes, that's right. They're carrying they've already got an immune response to it. So.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think we should be really focusing on the many, many more important things that are going on in society and in terms of creating diseases. And one of the big issues is that sometimes we focus too much on medicines and not enough on prevention. I mean, of course, vaccines are important for prevention, but only when there's very good evidence that they actually work and they're effective. And there are many vaccines now that have been produced that we haven't got strong evidence of effectiveness that are actually currently being debated and in dispute.
Yeah, I completely agree. It sounds like scaremongering from the World Health Organization. So what was the story you wanted to talk about this week?
Well, I think I want to bring one very close to home, which is about the junior doctors and the fact that junior doctors are balloting for strike action. And I think the really interesting stories is the letters signed by the consultants at St Bartholomew's Hospital, the London Hospital in London, and also at Birmingham, coming out completely in support of their junior doctors. They've said, we will support you if you need to take strike. What
we're
Jeremy
covered.
Hunt's doing is reprehensible. However, we will cover you. We will manage. We will make sure that patients don't suffer, and we will find a way of managing, but we completely support you. And this story, of course, ties into a much, much bigger story, which is about what the Health and Social Care Act 2012 has done in terms of abolishing the NHS in England. People probably don't realise that, but it's removed the duty to provide universal health care and key services throughout England. And actually, what that actually means now is that the government can withdraw funding, it can close services, and now you're seeing shooting up all over the place private hospitals, private GP surgeries. Mm. And that's really quite tragic because we've had an NHS since 1948. And Scotland and Wales still have an NHS. So we need it back. So the big story is that these junior doctors, their crusade, their actions are directly linked to the government's assault on the NHS and its decision to privatise it.
It's so true. I've got friends who are junior doctors, and they were saying what the changes he's asking, people are just not going to be able to work those extra hours and take that 30% pay cut, and they will leave the NHS. And she was saying, if it goes through, the NHS will die, and they're fighting to save the NHS. And a lot of people don't realise that. They think they're just fighting for themselves, but they're fighting to save the National Health Service, which they absolutely believe in.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And actually, one of the problems is that we've got a major shortage of doctors throughout the country. It's a major shortage of general practitioners, for example. So in many areas of the country, GP practices are closing under the weight of the government withdrawing funds so that GPs can't even earn a decent living now. And so they're locking up their surgeries, and they're having to leave. So I think really what we need to do is we need to bring back our NHS, which means getting the NHS bill, which is currently in Parliament, getting a movement behind the NHS bill 2015. We need to get behind that bill to bring back the NHS. If we don't, then we've had it. So the junior doctor struggle is really, really important. It's a sort of a catalyst to highlight what's going on in all of the rest of our NHS. The hospitals should not be closing and sinking under the weight of debt because they can't afford it, and due to paying out very large private sector contracts, for example, under things called the Private Finance Initiative.
No, so, I mean, I can't. To think of the UK without the NHS is just such a terrifying thought in itself.
Generations fought for our NHS, and that's why we've got it in place. It was a social contract the government had with its people, and it's a disgrace and abomination that the government has now abolished the NHS. So what it's doing is pouring money in, but that money is increasingly going to break up the NHS into private provision and for-profit corporations, which include many of the multinationals, which actually have tax havens. So the money is just leaking out to shareholders and abroad.
Well, if anyone needs inspiration for a terrifying outfit, why do you not go as dressed as Jeremy Hunt tonight?
Absolutely. And Andrew Lansley, his predecessor. Between Andrew Lansley did the main damage in that he was on the... It was under his watch, under the... Actually, it was under the coalition's watch that the NHS was so disgracefully abolished the whole model of providing universal health care.
I didn't know that. Kept it all slightly under wraps.
They did. Yeah. They didn't tell us what they were doing.
So everyone, get behind the junior doctors.
Absolutely.
We are supporting
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
And Amna, producer Amna, what story have you got for us this week?
So it's a very Halloween-y story. There's an asteroid, no need to worry, it's hurtling towards us at 7,000 to 8,830 miles per hour. And this 1,300-foot wide object will make its closest approach to Earth. It's being dubbed Spooky. But it, you know, poses no harm to us at all, but you're able to watch it tonight, I think. So
a bit of a Halloween treat for any space lovers out there.
Yeah.
Going to observe the asteroid. So we're going to have another song, but afterwards we will be talking all about the dangers of rugby and the horrifying stories that it has created. Alison, what's our next song going to be?
Well, I thought since we're going into rugby, we should talk about the harms. A lot is made of the benefits. Everybody, you know, the young men all think it makes them into...
It's macho.
Yeah, macho, very strong characters. So I thought we'd pick a song by Johnny Cash called Hurt.
What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end, and you could have it all, my empire of dirt. I will let you down, I will make you hurt.
Absolutely beautiful there from Johnny Cash. Well, if you've just joined us, you're listening to Science Mixtape, and here with me today we have Alison Pollock, who is the author of Tackling Rugby. Now, this is raising a really important issue that a lot of people aren't really aware of. Every week, young children are hospitalised on the playing fields of Britain, but this data is not collected, nor is there any concerted attempt to work out how to make the sport safer. And Alison's actually written a book looking at peer-reviewed research, which sets out the true risks associated with the sport and raises some uncomfortable questions that maybe we haven't really thought about ourselves. So Alison, would you tell me how you actually sort of got interested in this and what compelled you to write that book?
Well, I started this work about 10 years ago. It was after actually one of my sons was injured, not just once, but actually a total of 3 times playing rugby. But the second, he broke his leg, and then he had a very bad smashed zygoma cheekbone and concussion.
Oh, my gosh.
And I realised, well, you feel very guilty as a parent, but I also had been raising concerns before that because I'd observed the high number of boys playing rugby in Edinburgh who were actually... crippled and walking down, you know, the drives or to school through town with plasters on their legs or their arms or dislocated shoulders. And I was really, really concerned because I was hearing so much about rugby injury. And at that time then I wrote immediately to the chief medical officers, to health and safety, to the children's commissioners. In fact, I wrote before my son had his third injury. And it was a wall of silence. And I realised that we
just
had
no response.
No
at
response.
All.
No, it was really quite shocking. And I realised then we had one of rugby's dirty little secrets, which was to cover up. And indeed, the establishment went to great lengths to cover up. I went to see the Scottish Rugby Union and asked for the data, because they are meant to collect data on all injuries, especially the injuries that affect, you know, deaths and also injuries that result in going to hospital. But they only collect it if people are hospitalised overnight. But even if you break your leg or your arm or your collarbone, more often than not, you're discharged on the same day.
Yeah,
you don't have an overnight stay, so you don't get counted in the statistics. And then they said, well, actually, they hadn't been bothering to monitor or measure the statistics for a few years because somebody had been off sick. And I thought this was an extraordinary dereliction of duty. And then when I tried to find out what was going on in the schools, of course, none of them were really collecting injury data, and neither was health and safety, because it's been so eviscerated by the government. It's had not enough funding to do the jobs it needed. So for the next 10 years, I really took on the side, because I was doing a lot of other work, so this was mainly sort of evenings and weekends, and it's really putting together all the worldwide data on rugby and rugby injuries in children. And it was pretty horrifying, actually. It confirmed all my worst suspicions.
So what did
you find? But there was a huge denial all along. Well, what I found is that the rates and risks of injury are extraordinarily high. And that since the game became professional in 1995, in fact, the risks and rates of injuries have doubled in the adult game and tripled in the children's game. So that tells you that something bad is going on. And depending on the definition of injury, the risk of an injury in a season can go from 10% to 90%. For a child.
90%.
Really, as high as 90%, depending what definition you use. So you could be including, you know, cuts and scratches and bruises.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So anything. But actually, it's pretty high, even it. And so I set out to do a study in Scotland of six Scottish schools. So the chief medical officer actually then got on board and helped me about 10 years ago. And we set out to do this study of six schools. And then we found that the injury rates were really very high, as one is, you know, one in six, one in eight chance of injury in a season. And these injuries
were
quite severe.
At least two on rugby teams,
pretty
much.
It's really, really shocking, because actually every week that children are being injured. But of course, these were concussions, fractures, dislocated shoulders. So they were resulting in a lot of time off play. So one of the issues about the definition of rugby is time off play. You have mild, moderate, severe, depending on whether it's a week, a month or several months off play. And there's a whole lot of work around that. But the other thing that came out very strongly from all the studies, and from our study as well, was the contact was really important. Rugby is a collision sport. It's very unusual compared with other sports, as the collision is built into the game.
And something like collision's more of an accident.
70 to 80% of all the injuries are occurring during collision. And most of the injuries, 75, three quarters of the injuries, are occurring during the tackle.
Yeah.
And two thirds of concussions really come into public focus with the National Football League and the big multi-billion pound settlement, the billion-dollar
settlement. Absolutely. So if anyone hasn't heard about that, this year, Americans, National Football League, NFL, had to pay a $1 billion settlement to concussion-related brain injuries among 18,000 of its players.
Yes. I mean, that's and they had suppressed and hidden the harms. And that's a real worry, is that the rugby union's been in denial for years and years and years. So people have been raising this as an issue for decades. In fact, relatives of mine have been raising it as an issue 30 years ago. In the British Medical Journal, they were raising it. That was the extraordinary thing. I found that people were constantly raising the question of harms. But of course, if you don't collect the data and if you don't monitor it, then you can go into a complete denial of the harms.
Yeah.
And the problem is that the studies are all done in little studies all over the world. And it's only until you start to bring these studies together that you see the true impact of the harms and how devastating they are. So three quarters of all injuries occurring during the tackle and collision. And two-thirds of all the concussions are occurring during the tackle. So actually that led me to say, well, we mustn't focus on secondary prevention. We've got to get primary prevention. We've got to stop the injuries happening. And of course, the most extraordinary thing was that the rugby unions continued to be in denial. They used ad hominem attack, quite a lot of abuse at times.
Wait, what do you mean by an ad hominem
attack?
Well,
they would abuse the people who were actually pointing out what was wrong. They would actually say, well, you don't know, understand what you're talking about, or you're wrong,
and
or you've
kind
got
of
a personal agenda, or, you know. But now they're coming around to it because of this National Football League, and because now concussion
is
one
of
the top causes. Yeah, money talks, and it's now one of the top causes of injury. When the community rugby a surveillance project called CRISP has actually looked at that and shown concussion is right up there. It's been highly underreported because people would, especially professional players, would rather play on than have to leave the pitch when they've had a concussion.
I was just going to say, for those that don't know, what are the dangers of a concussion? When you get a concussion, what happens to you? Because there are long-term effects as well, aren't there?
Well, there are short-term effects and long-term effects. And in children, because their brains are developing, it's really very worrying. You can, of course, have headaches, blindness, hearing loss, fitting, memory loss, educational cognition, so you can actually have your educational abilities impaired for a few weeks, and it can take quite a long time to recover that. But now we're really worried because it's the whole problem is of course about repeat concussions, because there's a concern that maybe the blood-brain barrier is somehow damaged. And so you're going to get chemical imbalances or perhaps even viruses or prions crossing the blood-brain barrier. Nobody quite knows. But long term down the road, we know from chronic traumatic encephalopathy called CTE through repeat concussions, you might then be going on to get dementia long term, and of course Parkinson's disease and other kinds of neurological diseases.
So these degenerative diseases do seem to be linked to brain
injury. Well, there are associations now, but of course, like everything else, the research hasn't been done properly. We haven't collected the data and we haven't done the research, but we now have enough data to act, especially for children, where we have a special duty of care to children. Local authorities and the government have a special duty of care. So it's absolutely horrendous that Jeremy Hunt, yet again, is rolling out one of the most dangerous sports in schools right across the country. That's in all the state schools. He's actually rolling it out as one of the key competitive sports.
Yeah, so for those who may have not heard, what has he actually said? He sort of made it compulsory?
No, it's not compulsory, but they've identified in state schools it isn't. In many schools it can be compulsory, especially in the private sector.
Yeah, it was for the boys.
In my school,
it was compulsory for them to play rugby, and it was compulsory for me to play netball.
And that was in a state school as well.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. And actually, this idea of compulsion goes right against the rights of the child. It goes against the Children's Act and the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, where you've got a duty to inform, protect and prevent injury. So the governments are in dereliction of that duty, and the chief medical officers need to act, and so do the children's commissioners. They need to take steps to stop this crazy move by Jeremy Hunt and the Education Secretary to roll out the sports. So we really need to take this seriously and to take steps to do that.
I think that's a perfect time to put on your next song and reflect on what we've learned. So what do you think your next song is?
Well, of course, injuries cause great harm. They cause concussion and they cause broken bones and dislocated shoulders. And so I thought I'd combine the Halloween theme with the terrible harms that children and their families can be left with. And it's the children and families that suffer. And I've chosen Your Bones by a great band of Monsters and Men, which, as my brother said, would, if I, he's actually proposed this one. He said you might even sound faintly hip if you go with this one. But Your Bones of Monsters and Men.
Sad goodbye to you, my friend, as the fire spread. All that's left are your bones that will soon sink like stones. So hold on. Hold on to what we are. Hold on to your heart.
You're back listening to Science Mixtape, and today we are talking about the horror of rugby, because it's Halloween and the Rugby World Cup. We asked at the beginning of the show, what are your rugby horror stories? A producer, Amna, and we've been getting some tweets in. What have been your favourites?
My favourite is definitely David Priest, who says, does Graham Rowntree's ears qualify? So if you don't know who that is, he's infamous for having what's known as cauliflower ears, and that's essentially if you're in the scrum, second row, you have to rub up against other people's thighs and you just flatten your ears and it looks like cauliflower. It's really horrible. That's why people wear the hats now.
Oh gosh. And Gabby Hayward has also sent in that she doesn't have a rugby horror story, but she and her friends are dressing up as dead rugby players to combine rugby and horror today, and they're watching the match down in Twickenham. Good luck to you guys. That sounds like an awesome outfit. So we've been hearing from the wonderful Alison Pollock all about her research into sort of the injuries that people just aren't talking about that happen in rugby, and what we should be doing about it, and preventing tackling from being played in children's sport, because that is where most of the injuries, particularly concussions, are held. I'm sure a lot of people listening would say, what right do we have to stop people from playing a sport that they love? Because you said yourself you have two sons, and you actually stopped your younger son from playing, and that he was quite upset about that. So, in yes, Jeremy Hunt is rolling out rugby across the UK, but there are a lot of benefits to playing sports. We've got a problem of many children these days not doing enough physical education. At least rugby is one that there's a lot of national pride and identity behind. So what would you say to those people?
I'd say we shouldn't conflate physical activity and exercise with sport. Physical activity and physical exercise, that's why it was called PE in school, is really, really important. And everybody needs to walk, swim, run, you know, do whatever they need to do to make them feel good. But that is not the same as playing competitive, dangerous sports like rugby when you've got contact. So that's why we're arguing that you should take the contact out of rugby and make it tag or touch rugby for children. Now, there are 2.4 million players in the UK that play rugby. There'll probably be 50 to 100 professional players. So most of these players will never be professional. So why should they be subject to such great risks of harm, especially children? And for children, we've got a special duty of care, a duty of care to look after them. So we have to balance what the risks are and the harms are against actually informing and protecting them. And at every stage, I informed and protected my children. And where it was necessary, I took steps to prevent the injury. Now, as for the nanny state and cotton wool, wrapping your kit, which is a common argument, is when a child is hurt, that child is injured, that child is inert, loses confidence and can no longer play. So they're much more likely to become the couch potato, retreating into themselves and losing confidence. And actually, injury is the most common reason for children giving it up. But another horrifying statistic is the number of attendances to A&E. Now, the NHS is under huge pressure. We've heard already the government's seeking to abolish it and the risks, and that means that we've got to try and reduce attendances. Now, we know from studies in Northern Ireland that 40% of all the sports-related injury attendances were due to rugby. 40%.
Wow.
And that is Northern Ireland. In a study we've just finished in Oxford in 10 to 19-year-olds, 20% of injuries were due, sport-related injuries were due to rugby. It was right up there at the top. So it's really worrying. We're talking about tens of thousands of A&E attendances and thousands of admissions every year, some of them catastrophic. No child should lose their life. No child should be paraplegic or quadriplegic, lose their ability to walk and to function because of a game. If a game brings these kind of harms, where a child has to have time off school for prolonged periods, where a child loses the life they once had due to a spinal injury or due to a severe concussion, or can no longer play sport because of the dislocated shoulders and the terrible fractures that they've had of their pelvis. I have had mothers write in their tens and twenties expressing their fears of the child being harmed and from their children's bedside. So at the end of the day, the nanny state picks up the tab for the injuries, for the prolonged disability of the child, but above all, so does the child, and above all, so do the parents and the carers. They're left with the injured child, and so is the child, and that damage doesn't go away. That damage is with them for the rest of their lives, which is why we need to take special steps to protect our children. But we also need to be taking special steps to protect the 2.4 million players who haven't been told the true risks and nature of injuries. And I'm particularly worried about the sport being rolled out now in a big way to women, because women actually are more vulnerable from injuries, and the evidence shows that actually, especially girls, if they get concussed, are probably more likely to have severe consequences than boys.
That's so interesting. I had no idea. And actually, producer Amna plays rugby.
I do, yeah. It's been very complicated, I think, I love rugby, I love playing it, but I want to play it safely. And I think I have to really ask myself, can I? So we were talking about concussions and kind of the pressure to keep on playing. And, you know, it's not really, it's not just in men's sport where if you get hurt and you stay on, you know, you're a top lad. It's, you see it in women's sports too. And, you know, I had this, someone tackled me in a really dangerous way, really high, you know, really smashed my head onto the ground. It just hurt. So, like, I almost like blacked out a little bit. And then I got up. I was off the pitch for about 5 minutes, but because another problem with women's rugby is like there's not really that many, so it's always hard like trying to field an entire team. So you feel really bad if you are injured and you stay out. So I just kind of got back in there, and you kind of have to wonder, if I got another really bad tackle, what kind of position would I be?
Players talk about this all the time, the pressure to carry on playing, and of course if it's in a big game, their own pride, because they want to be the man or woman of the match. But actually, you should not have carried on. You should have been off for at least 3 weeks, and you should have had a proper assessment. Mm. Because the big risk of repeat concussions, or even another one within a day or a few weeks, is double impact syndrome, the risk of dying. Mm. And actually, we've seen quite a few of
that. You can die from two concussions.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's a tragic story of Benjamin Robinson, whose parents have been so magnificent in Ireland. The boy died playing rugby when he had two concussions. They knew after the first one that he was seriously, seriously hurt. He was disorientated. He didn't know where he was going. And then there have been a number among young people. Rowan Stringer in Canada died this year, and there have been a few in South Africa. And there have been a number of deaths among young people from National Football League as well this year. So we are talking about children dying from a game. This is really serious. And in your case, you should have been right off that pitch. Anybody that gets even a suspected concussion should be right off and not playing again for 3 weeks at least, and having a proper assessment. And that's why it's really important. By all means, why don't you think about Eurotag? If you love your rugby, you can still get a lot of enjoyment from it by taking the tackle out of the game and carrying on making it tag or touch rugby or Eurotag. Doing a different kind of game, which is still fast, very skillful. Because the other big criticism is the game is less skillful, because now you're into contact and collision all the time, rather than the skill of running and throwing the ball.
It would completely change it if professional rugby players didn't tackle. Well, you wouldn't be so big anymore, would they?
Well, they wouldn't. They wouldn't need to do all this bulking up. And the real worry is the bulking up is also happening in the child's game. The children are going to the gym. They're taking these terrible protein supplements, which can do damage to their kidneys. And hormonal function and testosterone failure. So you're actually looking at a range of issues when you're bulking up. And of course, these children are hiding very precious and very fragile bones and brains behind these great big bodies. And the professional game, even, I don't know if you heard a couple of days ago, but even on Radio 4, the Today programme, they're now calling for major changes to the professional game. Mm. So World Rugby has to, and the rugby unions, have to wake up and take their responsibilities to players seriously.
Yeah. And what's really interesting, so the American football, they've like slowly tried to change their form of tackling to more rugby form of tackling. So I was looking into this, and this is kind of shift, being like, we want to do a safer tackle, so we want to do what the Europeans are doing. But I was telling someone else about this, and they were just like, this is just a blind leading the blind.
It is. And there were two deaths last week in young men in American football. It's just shocking. Yeah.
How does it compare with other sports, though? Because, I mean, boxing's just as dangerous. Horse riding, you can get terrible spine injuries.
Well, boxing is banned. It's banned for children, and for very good reason, because of the concussion. And so it's not played in schools. And the second thing, and the BMA, the British Medical Association, spearheaded a major campaign about this. Horse riding and eventing as a pursuit is very, very dangerous, but it's a pursuit really of the rich, and it's not actually played in schools. We're talking about a game that is being played by 2.4 million people, and that's being rolled out to schools across the UK. And it's being rolled out to women and girls as well.
I think what's also really interesting about women's rugby is you really struggle to find kind of like trained coaches. There were loads of cases where we'd book the pitch, but if there was a men's rugby match, they'd get priority over us. So it also made me worry. Always made me think, like, how did I didn't know, like, if I'm concussed, I shouldn't play again for 3 weeks.
That's absolutely true. And the other problem is that the coaches and the referees aren't necessarily trained either. Mm. Because if you're training to be a PE teacher, you're training in physical exercise and physical activity. You're not being trained in the complexity of the laws of the game or how to deal with a collision sport. And nor should you be, actually, to be quite frank. But that, as a result of that, you're having people in charge of games and matches who really have no real detailed knowledge of the match. And you can see how referees get it wrong in the professional game. Mm. We saw that only last week with Scotland.
God,
you know,
too
how,
soon.
You know, they get it wrong. So if they're getting it wrong or they're missing things in the professional game, and you're seeing foul play in the, also in the professional game, then what on earth is happening in the amateur game, which is really relatively unmonitored?
Well, for anyone who's going to be watching the final tonight, which I think we probably all are, you can now take this extra information that we've learned and actually see how brave these people are being and how terrifying that game really is. And I think nothing epitomises, when you think of rugby and you think of horror, nothing epitomises that more than A, terrifying pictures of tackles, and B, the hacker, which I have for you now.
A proud moment for two players in particular, Cody Taylor.
There we go. That was what we will be hearing tonight. It's going to give us all a fright, along with our next song, which I have chosen because we felt like it was a Halloween theme. We wanted to all get something in there. So this one is, of course, Thriller by Michael Jackson. You start to freeze as someone looks you right between the eyes. Thriller indeed, and we have a thrilling experiment for you right now. As we said at the top of the show, we are going to be making some ghostly M&Ms. All you need to do this is some M&Ms, obviously, some sort of container to put water in. So we've got two little glass bowls and some warm water. And what you are going to do, pour your water into your little glass bowl. Very nice. And here you go, Alison. And then you want to take some M&Ms. Now, we've got peanut ones, but I'm sure they'll work just as well. You can take a few different colours, and you want to let them dissolve in the water. So you're just going to pop a few in and leave them
and
in
and try and not
the
eat them all before they hit the water.
Absolutely. And then you don't want to do anything. You literally just want to let them sit there. You want to quickly tilt them over so the M's are facing up. But otherwise, just let them sit there and leave them for a few minutes. So while we are leaving ours for a few minutes, I'm going to play you a little bit of actually some archive of myself. But anyway, from a previous show that I did last year, where I'm talking about why we find scary films it's actually quite enjoyable sometimes. So it's about what is actually happening in our body when we're scared and why that makes frightening films, scary films, quite delicious. Yeah, so why we like being scared. Well, first of all, I think it's important to explain what happens when we are feeling scared or perceiving a threat. So either we're preparing to run away or face and fight whatever is threatening us. we are going to limit our insulin production, which is going to increase our blood sugar levels. And that means we've got lots and lots of energy pumping around, feeling great.
Helps if you eat some Halloween candy.
Always carry that if you're going to explore a haunted house. And we're going to be breathing faster to take in more oxygen. Our heart's beating faster. And in case you have any injury, you don't want this injury to stop you from being able to run as fast as you can. So you're going to have some endorphins and dopamine flying around your brain just to cushion any pain that might be there. And this is what you're going to feel when you're scared. Now, this is your, what we like to call, quick and dirty response. So you've got two systems.
I've not heard it called that before.
I have not either. I like
you
that.
Is this different from the fight or flight response?
The fight and flight response is the quick and dirty response. So when your eyes or your ears or whatever your senses are perceiving a threat,
yeah,
there's two channels in your brain that this signal is sent through. They were discovered by Joseph Ledoux, who was an American neuroscientist. And so the very quick one goes straight to the amygdala, which is sort of your sort of emotional fear processing center of the brain, and it goes there through largely unconscious areas of the brain you are unaware. It's very, very quick. It doesn't get processed. It just sort of says, ah,
yeah,
release the fear response.
Oh Lord, good Lord.
So you get all of this bodily reaction instantaneously, and at the same time the same signals are going through what he termed the high road, and they're being processed up into the more cortical areas of your brain.
So that's the cortex.
Yeah, absolutely, prefrontal lobes. And this is what's going to make sense of the signals. So if you're just responding to a dark shape in the corner and then suddenly you realise, oh, it's a mop or a broom, not some like weird scarecrow about to kill me.
Yeah,
but it takes longer for you to process them because it's going through this conscious part of your brain. So you've already reacted, you've already got all this adrenaline coursing through you before you realise you're okay. So when we watch films, particularly scary films that, you know, are trying to make us freak out and jump, we are responding in both of these ways to those films. We're responding in the quick and dirty way where our body goes, ah, and you get all that adrenaline, and then your body goes, oh, it's just a film. And so you get all those emotions and that heightened arousal and the endorphins in that safe environment. And that, I think, is what particularly sort of adrenaline junkies and people predisposed to enjoy extreme sports. That's why those sorts of people love horror films, because you are being scared, but you know it's okay, and you just get to have all that arousal. There we go, the fight and flight response. So we like scary films because it gives us adrenaline. So what have we got at the moment? Well, our M&Ms have been slowly dissolving. This is because they are coated with sugar, and sugar dissolves in water. And if you leave it really, really still, it actually looks really beautiful. So I've got sort of a red and orange and a blue, and they're all, the colours are all just kind of staying around them, mixed together like an artist's palette. And then what you should see happening is those white M's are made from edible ink, and that does not dissolve in water. So once enough of the sugar coating has dissolved off, you should actually see the M's start to float to the surface and hang around on the very top, ghostly, all by themselves.
I think I made a bit of a mess of mine, all the inks muddled up.
Oh yeah, so we've got one with some nice separated colours and one where with a it's almost like a
muddy
layer. It's a brilliant sort of green on top.
Underneath it.
Yeah. Oh look, see? There's another ghostly M. I broke it.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Now I can see the ghostly M's. Very good.
They actually look better in yours because you've got the nice green sludge for them to hang out in. So there we go. Very simple, very easy to do. And can amaze your friends. Abracadabra, I'm going to make the M's float to the surface. So all that remains is for us to reveal what the deadliest animal in the world is.
We've had a few more suggestions.
Yeah, what have we had?
So Thomas goes, a Jeremy Kyle guest. Gigi said, a man. And then she tweeted back, actually, no, a mosquito.
What do you think, Alison? You thought a snake?
I thought some sort of snake, yeah.
And Amna, do you have any ideas?
Oh, no. I'm not sure at all, actually.
Well, I was thinking about this because Halloween, there's a lot of animals that we see as scary and deadly. I mean, spiders and bats, snakes, wolves or werewolves. And they are all animals that can bite you. And, you know, particularly with spiders, you know, they're venomous. They can poison you. But actually, I don't know what her name is, the second tweet you read out. She is correct. The mosquito is the deadliest animal in the world.
Because it's carrying malaria.
Because it gives malaria, which kills billions of people. So it's not about poison. Yeah. It's about that parasite it's spreading. Yeah. So if you need any last minute ideas for a Halloween costume or some pumpkin carving, why don't you go as the world's deadliest animal, which is a mosquito. All I can say now is, Alison, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure. It's been great fun.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And I will never watch rugby in the same way again. Yeah. I've always been too scared to play it, and now I'm justified in being scared.
Absolutely.
And all that remains.
But I hope it just makes a difference. I really hope our governments will, you know, pay attention, and the rugby unions, and start to do something to protect our children.
Yeah, I hope so too. Watch this space. We'll be following it closely. So for our final song, producer Amna, this was your Halloween choice.
Yes, it's a favourite of mine is Time Warp by the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Thank you, goodbye, and happy Halloween.
It's just a jump to the left. Put your hands on your hips.
Science.